Dale's other world. And this is really a true honor for me because this man is involved in doing something that makes our world a better place, I think. Jed Caddick from EcoTours or EcoTours.com is on the telephone. And Jed, I'm going to kind of describe it, then you can add to it. But what you do is you take people to places around the world, often probably on their bucket list, to see wildlife in a way they could otherwise not likely do. Have I got that?
Yes, absolutely. And then thank you, Steve, for this opportunity to talk about what we do today. But yes, we take people to see usually endangered or rare wildlife. And then the little spin we put on it is that we like to involve a conservation partner in each of our destinations. So people get to meet someone who's working to help save the species. So, for instance, when we go to see the mountain gorillas in Rwanda, we meet the gorilla doctors, the veterinarians who provide health care to the gorillas. When we go to India, we meet an organization called Waste Warriors that's battling the impacts of garbage and people who live around the margins of the parks in India. So in each place, we like to obviously see the animal or species or environment in question, but we also like to leave a positive impact behind after we've left, that we've helped support one of the conservation groups that's working in the areas we visit.
So here's what it's like, is the way I think of it, is there you are watching in your living room Animal Planet or the National Geographic Channel, and you think, I wish I could be there. And what you do, Jed, is you take people there to see exactly, in some cases, what people dream a lifetime of seeing. And because you're a naturalist and because you know people there, you're able to do that.
That's right. And we're very privileged. Everywhere we go, we are blessed that we're going to these remarkable, unique locations, Patagonia in southern Chile, or the Masai Mara in Kenya, or the tiger reserves in India. And through a network of contacts and prior visits, we know exactly which time to go and exactly where to go to maximize our chances of seeing these incredible wildlife spectacles, whether it's the Great Migration or a puma hunting prey or a tiger in its natural habitat. We really work very hard to make those, you're absolutely right, those bucket list species and experiences, we try to make them predictable, accessible, available to anyone who has the time and energy, and sometimes the budget to be able to achieve it. Some of these activities are not cheap because we are going to remote places far away, and it might take a little while.
What is the most, and this is the question I suppose that people ask you at cocktail parties. I don't know how you ever get to anywhere because you're always on the go traveling. Yeah. But what is the most amazing experience you've ever had?
That is always a difficult one to answer. It's what's your most amazing experience and which is your favorite place? And the two most difficult things to answer. I think the wildlife experience that's actually moved me to tears is sitting face-to-face with mountain gorillas. I know I've done it with you, Steve.
Yep.
We've both had the privilege of doing that, and it really does move grown men to tears, sitting face to face with our, you know, closest, our cousins, if you will, in the animal kingdom. And it's really a very moving experience. So that is always high on my list, just because of the emotional component. But seeing a tiger in the wild hunting, or seeing a humpback whale breaching, those two really lift your spirits, but it hasn't moved me to tears. Those are you know, they feed your soul, but they don't move you in the same way that sitting staring into the eyes of a gorilla does.
All right.
So I would say that's my favorite experience.
Well, I want to talk about that a little bit. So let's talk about going to see mountain gorillas. Where do people go? How do they go ahead and get there? And what is the experience like?
Yeah, okay. Well, there's three countries where the mountain gorillas occur. That's Rwanda, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Sadly, the Democratic Republic of Congo remains a very dodgy place to visit. There's a lot of civil unrest, and I wouldn't recommend people go there. But in both Uganda and Rwanda, it's definitely possible to see the mountain gorillas. And in both countries, it's a well-organized activity. It's limited to very few people per day. But it is like clockwork. They guarantee you'll see the gorillas. They have teams of trackers that follow the gorillas each day, so they know where the gorillas are. So in terms of going there, you have to plan ahead. Only 8 people can visit each group of gorillas that is available to tourism. So it's a very limited number of people each day that have this opportunity. But they do deliver. Every day, people go up and they spend an hour with the gorillas. It's a special hour. It takes some work. The gorillas are in their natural habitat, so you have to hike anywhere from 45 minutes to 3 or 4 hours through the forest to get to them. They don't come on demand. You have to go to where they are.
And it's a it's
uphill.
Yeah,
they are mountain gorillas. Yeah, you have to climb. Sometimes it's steep and muddy and slippery, and sometimes it's through fields of stinging nettles and brambles, and it's prickly. And sometimes it's like a walk in a nice alpine meadow with the sun shining, or it can be all of those experiences all in the space of 45 minutes.
But you do have help doing it.
Oh, absolutely. We employ porters who help everyone get up the mountain. They carry their gear for them because you need to go with your rain gear, your cameras, your pack lunch, your bottles of water. It's a big, heavy backpack. So we provide everyone with a porter who carries all your stuff and literally pulls you up the mountain. They live there. So they go up every day. They're used to the altitude. They're used to the conditions. And by using porters, the beauty is we're also providing local income to the local people who live around the border of the park. So it's a win-win for everyone. The locals are getting money from the park, and we're getting assistance hauling ourselves up the mountain because none of us are getting any younger.
And then when you get to that mountaintop, or wherever the gorillas are, first off, you may hear it in the distance, the gorillas sort of communicating to one another. You may frankly smell it, you know, when you're there. And then you put down that gear that the porters do, and then you take your camera, and then this magic begins to happen. It's as if you're in an audience and the gorillas are on stage, except the audience is right there.
Absolutely. No, it's a real privilege to be able to do it. The gorillas carry on about their business, almost indifferent to our presence. Almost, but not quite. You can tell they know we're there. But they really do carry on eating, playing, feeding, climbing, farting, whatever it is the gorillas are doing. They do it with you there or not there, you know? It's a magical experience. It really is.
And sometimes they really do get awfully close.
Oh, absolutely. Some of the youngsters especially are inquisitive. They'll come and grab a hold of your raincoat or tug on your pant leg in a playful manner. We don't like to encourage that, but we sometimes can't stop it from happening. The gorillas set the rules, really. We try to stay neutral, you know, gathered in a quiet little group watching them, but sometimes they're more intrigued in a, they're as intrigued about us as we are about them sometimes.
You know, I've you tell me if I'm putting it correctly, there's more of a threat because gorillas are big and they're very strong, a whole lot stronger than any 20 of us. But we're actually more of a threat, and it's our germs that potentially could be the threat.
Absolutely. You know, they're susceptible to every disease, virus, cold, bacteria we're susceptible to, they are susceptible to. So anyone, when the gorillas get too close to us, if we sneeze on them or are carrying some kind of bug, they're likely to catch it, and it can be much more deadly to them than it is to us because they've not been exposed to some of our germs and illnesses, just as happened when Europeans first arrived in North America, that the native Indians were so susceptible to smallpox and all the European diseases that we had all become, that the Europeans had all become immune to. They were novel diseases to the Native Americans. Well, as it is with the gorillas, we are, it's a double-edged sword. Tourism is helping to save the gorillas by providing tremendous revenue to the parks and areas where gorillas occur, but we are also perhaps their greatest threat. So there are great efforts underway to make sure people don't get too close, that we limit the numbers, that anyone who is showing any visible signs of illness is not allowed to visit the gorillas.
But because because of the tours you and a few others lead, the country is now benefiting in the case of Rwanda. I know that. I suspect the same may be true in Uganda. And these countries are benefiting by providing jobs. For one thing, you've got these tourists coming, but it's also the money that the tourists bring in.
Absolutely. No. Without tourism, there's no question in my mind that the gorillas would have become extinct long ago, that their habitat would have been turned into agricultural fields, the trees would have been chopped down for timber. But everyone in Rwanda and Uganda recognizes by protecting the forest, they're protecting the goose that's laying the golden egg, that there's a revenue stream because of those forests and because of the gorillas, and everyone's very motivated to protect and conserve and the habitat. And obviously the gorillas can only survive as long as the habitat is healthy and present. And so it's the shining example globally of how ecotourism can help to save the environment.
And not only save the environment, but and not only the mountain gorillas, which I believe is probably the only grade 8 species holding its own now, but also all the other animals that live in the park, that live in that ecosystem.
Absolutely. And in addition to all that, the beauty of protecting the environment is it's also protecting the water source for the human population outside the park. The forest now acts as a big sponge, and that water gets slowly released. The rivers and streams all have year-round water that helps irrigate all the farms and provide water to the communities around the volcanoes where the gorillas occur. Without that forest, the water would run off rapidly, and there'd be no water for half the year.
No.
A healthy environment is good for the animals. It's good for the people, too. It's a win-win for everyone.
Now, for those old enough to remember Dianne Fossey and those specials she did...
There's not many people as old as you and I, Steve.
Hey, well, speak for yourself there. For those, thanks a lot. So for those that do remember, and of course I only saw the reruns, but for those that do remember all those National Geographic specials, these are the relatives of the same gorillas that she actually personally in many cases habituated?
Absolutely. And there's still, believe it or not, there's still a few gorillas surviving that were around when Dianne Fossey was there.
Wow.
There are still a few, but for sure the the nieces, the nephews, the grandchildren, the offspring, they're all there, of the gorillas that Diane studied and named, the Digits and the Uncle Berts and the Emmanuels that she was studying, their offspring and their descendants are all still there. So it's very fun. Very fun to appreciate the family trees and the lineages that of the gorillas. And the beauty is that the rangers that take us to the gorillas, they know all the gorillas individually. They know who's descended from who the uncle was, who the grandfather was, who the brothers and sisters are. It makes for a much more enriching encounter.
And I want to explain that encounter a little bit and do a bit of a better job. So there you are hiking up for, as you say, anywhere from 45 minutes to more than several hours. You finally make it up there. You're at this very high altitude, and then they're there, the gorillas, a family of gorillas, including maybe a very large silverback or two or three, including some very young gorillas, probably, just a variety of all different ages. And they get, you say they go about their business. Do they ever threaten people at all?
I have never seen that. And to my knowledge, in Rwanda, there have been no incidents of gorillas ever harming a person. There is a story in Uganda of a gorilla once biting one of the guides, but I don't know all the details of that. But certainly there is I know of no instances where the gorillas have harmed or hurt the tourists.
And they go about, as you said, their business, which means you describe some body functions that, okay, they do that, but they also groom themselves. The young gorillas play with one another. They're eating a lot because that's what they do a lot. They're right there. They are close enough to touch you or you touch them. You don't. But they are right there, and I want to be sure that people understand that you're guaranteed to have this experience. Now, if you go out, and we'll talk about some of these other things. I mean, you mentioned that you've seen a tiger kill or maybe lion hunt in Africa. There's likely no guarantee you're going to see that. You'll see lion, but not see them hunt necessarily or kill if that's what you want to see. But there is a guarantee, and correct me if I'm wrong, a guarantee that not once, is it once or twice, that you will actually see gorillas?
Well, depending how many times you opt to trek, we guarantee that you'll see gorillas each time you trek. So we always include at least one trek. Some people trek two times. We've had one gentleman once who extended his stay, and he trekked seven times to the gorillas over 10 days.
Wow.
So he saw gorillas on 7 days. So it's all according to how much time you have and how much budget you have. It is not an inexpensive activity. Just to give you an idea, in Rwanda, it's $750 per person per day just for the permit to go into the park. So you can see that very quickly it's a massive economic engine for Rwanda. But they only issue a maximum of 80 permits per day. So that's the maximum number of people who can go see gorillas on any given day in Rwanda. It's 80 people. But each person will have paid $750. So you're talking a revenue of $60,000 per day to the gorillas, or to gorilla conservation. Obviously, the gorillas don't get paid. The money goes to the government of Rwanda to help support the park and the rangers and the trackers and the health of that whole system.
All right, but that's not the only place you go to. And one more thing about the gorillas. The Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project, which you helped support. So you mentioned very early on, and one of the great things I like about your group, I mean, you're all about preserving nature, but you walk the walk, and you give money back to fill in the blank wherever you are locally. In this case, the Mountain Gorilla Veterinary Project, and you are so committed that at least at one point I know you were on their board of directors. Tell me, give me, because I do want to go on and talk about some other things, but a brief sort of 101 as to what they're all about and why they're so extraordinarily important.
Oh, no, thank you for that opportunity. Yes, the gorilla doctors, as you said earlier, it's the only great ape species in the world that's actually increasing in numbers. And that's partly because of tourism, partly because of this economic engine and the commitment of the governments of Rwanda, Uganda, and Congo to protect these remarkable animals. But it's also because of the amazing work of the gorilla doctors who provide health care to these wild animals. There are many challenges to doing that. You can't bring the gorillas into the clinic for a physical. Everything they do has to be done out in the forest, out in the wild. So there are many logistical challenges to providing that health care. You know, if they have to provide medication, they can only do it one time. So they have to evaluate very carefully. They have to use a syringe mat that they blow through a blowpipe that when it hits the animal, it discharges the drug and then drops out. But then the animal won't let you ever get near it again with the blowpipe and syringe. It knows when it sees the blowpipe, uh-oh, there's something bad coming now. So they have to be very judicious. They have to do it where the other gorillas can't see what they're doing, because they don't want other gorillas to know what happened, because then if they ever need to be treated, they'll run away as soon as they see one of the veterinarians or the blowpipe. So there's a lot of challenges to providing health care to a wild animal, and you have to do it all without the silverback seeing what's going on, because he will be very protective of his gorillas. He doesn't want people, what he would consider harassing his family. So the gorilla doctors do some incredible work, and they have helped to turn the gorilla population around to the point where it is increasing. And it is the only great ape that the population is increasing in number.
Yeah, which is sad. Great for the mountain gorillas, but sad about all the others because...
Absolutely. It's very sad.
Yeah,
the rest of the world,
yep,
things are still in decline.
So South America is getting a lot of attention because of the recent Olympics. So let's go to South America. You do several trips there. Pick one, anyone, and I want to talk about it.
Sure. Well, let's pick one that's in Brazil then, because Brazil is the country in the spotlight right now because of the Rio Olympics. And we have a trip to Brazil where we go to an area called the Pantanal, which is in southern Brazil. And it's a mosaic of flooded grasslands and forest that isn't really set up yet in parks and reserves. It's a very remote area of Brazil that is mostly huge cattle ranches. And when I say huge, I mean really huge, 50,000 acres, 100,000 acre ranches. And the ranchers have learned to coexist with the wildlife. They haven't eliminated all the native species. They do kind of low-impact ranching. And on their property, they're fortunate to have, in addition to the cattle, they'll have tapirs and jaguars and monkeys and giant anteaters. And they've struck this beautiful balance between kind of farming and conservation. And so we love taking people there to expose them to this unique environment where man and wildlife have learned to coexist, and the ranchers now all supplement the income from the cattle farming with the income from tourists coming to see their ranches. So they've turned what used to be housing for the ranch hands into housing for small tour groups. And we visit a couple of different areas in the Pantanal, and during the course of a week, we'll see tapirs and giant anteaters and giant otters and a million capybara, which is the world's largest rodent. The funny, it looks like a hamster on steroids.
Yes.
And the real hook for going to the Pantanal is we can pretty much guarantee that you'll see jaguars in the wild.
Now, how do you do that? Because jaguars are pretty much nocturnal, or at least crepuscular, where they're out early in the morning and late in the afternoon. But, again, also overnight. So you don't take people out 3 in the morning, I suspect. So how do you
do that? We don't take them out at night. In this particular area we visit, the jaguars seem to have become habituated is too strong a word, but they've become more diurnal because their main prey is capybaras and caiman. And caiman are like these South American alligators. And the caiman and the capybaras sun themselves on the riverbanks during the day. So the jaguars, in order to eat, they've pretty much got to come out during the daytime. And they're cruising these riverbanks looking for a caiman or a capybara that's fallen asleep, and they can grab it before it dives into the water. So it's this unique convergence of the needs of the jaguar, and the needs of the jaguar have overridden that nocturnal habit, and they've come out more in the daytime. And if they want to eat, they've had to get used to being out in the daytime, and they've gotten used to seeing it. We're in boats. We're not on the riverbanks. That would actually be too dangerous. We're in boats cruising on the rivers, so we too are looking for caiman and capybara sitting on the riverbanks, and then we're looking for the jaguar that's hunting the caiman and capybara sitting on the riverbanks. And in the course of a few days, we can see as many as 10 to 20 jaguars in 3 or 4 days.
It's
crazy. It's crazy. People imagine the Amazon full of wildlife. I think the Pantanal is what people's imagination runs to, because when you actually go to the Amazon, you don't see jaguars and giant otters, and it's much more forested, and the animals are more nocturnal. But in this unique area of the Pantanal, there's this population of jaguars that hunts in the daytime, doesn't care about people in boats, and so they'll sit on the riverbank. We have many, many encounters where the jaguar has just sat on the riverbank looking at us as we sit looking at him or her for 2-3 hours. It's crazy.
Incredible.
It's a crazy place.
So what do you we're running out of time here, so just do a fast go through of where you take people, some of the other tours.
Sure, I'd love to. So we do the Pantanal of Brazil. We do Patagonia in Chile, where we see Torres del Paine National Park, spectacular scenery. And against that backdrop, we see guanacos and flamingos and foxes. But the real trophy there is that we see mountain lions. And again, it's another place where they've started to hunt in the daytime.
Wow.
And so it's so counter to what we expect. We do a trip to Peru where we go from the Amazon to the Andes, and we end at the spectacular ruins of Machu Picchu. We do the Galapagos Islands and wander around in Darwin's footsteps. We go to India to see the tigers.
I want to go back to the Galapagos for one moment. And
sure.
The other thing about the Galapagos is, yes, no matter who you are, you don't even have to be, in truth, Jed, with you. They're close encounters because all the animals there seem to be habituated to people, even the marine wildlife. It's an amazing, amazing experience. But the concern I have about the Galapagos is that so many of the people go as a tourist. The concern I have for you is that you're likely going to go with 80 of your best friends or more on a boat. You go out maybe if you're lucky in smaller groups, but you go in these pretty large groups. I have a sense, knowing you, you don't have 80 people or 120 people on a boat. You go in much smaller groups, and it's much more intimate.
We absolutely. We only charter a boat that can hold a maximum of 16 people. So we, just by default, we're going to be in a smaller group. You're right. There are some big ships there that spew out 100 people at a time, and they're all on the same trails doing. So you're seeing as many people as you're seeing animals. We do it in little groups. We try to pick itineraries that take us to the more remote, less visited spots of the Galapagos. But you're absolutely right. No matter which group you're in, the wildlife is incredibly approachable. It seems to have evolved in the absence of people or predators. So all the animals are very, very curious, very, very calm. You can get within inches of albatross and boobies and iguanas and giant tortoises. And it literally feels just as it must have felt for Charles Darwin when he went there a couple of hundred years ago. It takes your breath away, the Galapagos. It really does.
Yeah, yeah.
How approachable the wildlife is.
And all of your trips are kind of like bucket list trips. Ecotours.com is the website for further information. Before I let you go, Jed, one story, any story from anywhere on the planet, because I think you've been everywhere on the planet, because we've just touched. I mean, you offer many more trips. We just don't have time. But just once where something happened that is like, I've got to tell that story, like the time maybe an elephant stood on your head. I don't know what it was. Just any story.
I think one of my favorite experiences in the last couple of years was in the Falkland Islands. And we'd gone down there, and we expected to see penguins and elephant seals and sea lions and some remarkable marine life. But we visited this one island in the Falkland Islands, and early one morning, we were told, go down to the little tidal pool, and you might see an orca, a killer whale, come in. So we're like, okay. So at 4 o'clock in the morning, I went down to that pool with some of my group. And sure enough, as the tide came up, this little tidal pool filled with water, and next thing we knew, three or four orcas swam into this tidal pool that was no bigger than 50 feet across and were grabbing elephant seals out of the pool, dragging them out to sea and eating them out in the ocean.
Wow.
And that was just mind-blowing, to be so close to killer whales. And it was amazing, amazing. And, of course, if we'd come half an hour later, we would have witnessed nothing. There was no evidence that anything had ever taken place there. They dragged the elephant seals out into the ocean, and they're gone like a ghost.
See,
so
yeah,
we felt very privileged to have witnessed that. And, you know, there's just no evidence that it ever happened. And then as soon as the tide drops, they can't get into the pool. And the elephant seals play in this little tidal pool that for 23 hours a day is perfectly safe. But that 1 hour of high tide, the orcas can sneak in and grab them. And we were just very privileged to witness that. So that's one of my most recent but most amazing stories.
Well, I know you have thousands of amazing stories. It's my pleasure. It's my honor. As I said at the very beginning, you're a guy who's making the world a better place. So
thank you.
Thank
very
you.
Kind.
Thank you. And ecotours.com for further information. Thank you, Jed.
Thank you, Steve.